Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.
Welcome back to the dialogue on Reality Check Radio, and welcome back to our regular dialogue host, Dewa De Boer. How are you, Dewa?
Oh, I'm doing very well. Thank you, William. It is good to be back. And thank you very much for holding down the fort while I've been away.
Well, hopefully I've sort of done a halfway respectable job while you've been gone. So Dewa's been on holiday in Japan. And we thought that since he's back now, that one of the first things we would do is that I would sort of interview him about what he's got up to in Japan and what his thoughts on Japan are and any lessons sort of we can draw out of it. So let's get into it. Dewa, why did you choose to go to Japan and where did you go and did you enjoy it? Let's have a sort of logistical overview of the Japan holiday. Well, where did you go, the attractions, and let's see what we can sort of make of this.
That's right. I've got to keep this politically relevant, right, in the context of my show. And definitely that had something to do with it. This isn't why I went to Japan, but I found out before we were going that we'd be there during the elections in Japan as well. So they had recent elections, which are on. Maybe I'll talk a little bit about that later, sort of what their political issues were. But the main reason for going was actually that my wife, Amy, had always wanted to go to Japan. She'd been studying animation in college, university. She did a diploma in animation. And as everybody knows, you know, who are the best animators in the world, the ones who do a lot of drawing and animated movies and so on, is basically these Japanese studios. And that was a big driver for Japan. One of the other things that I find very interesting about Japan is the history. And I played a lot of strategy games and so on. And there's always Japanese civilizations you can play as, and Age of Empires and Total War Shogun, both very heavily feature Japanese history. And so that was a big part of the reason for both of us wanting to go. And I think as well, Japan is fairly close to New Zealand, straightforward to get to. I say fairly close, but it's straightforward to get there, about an 11-hour flight. At the moment, the yen is basically close to equal with the New Zealand dollar, about 10% off. So about 100 yen to one New Zealand dollar, or 110 yen to one New Zealand dollar. And that's actually due to their economy declining, which I think will feature in some of the discussion about Japanese politics, because they used to have their currency sort of similar, basically pegged to the US dollar. So you have 100 yen to one US dollar. And that was kind of basically, you know, their currency is mostly effectively denoted in cents, right? You know, like 100 cents to the dollar. Yet, because of their current economic situation, that has now declined, where it's become a very, very popular tourist destination for other people. And because it's actually, we're able to afford it, basically. It used to be very, very expensive for New Zealanders to go to Japan.
Yeah, well, when I think of Japan, I sort of think of this kind of more a country that's, if anything, more economically advanced than we are in New Zealand, and definitely more a kind of, I don't know more if more technologically advanced is the right word, but that they are more into their technology, they perhaps make better use of it, the more technology seems to feature quite prominently in the depictions of Japan that we get over here. They grew quite significantly, like in the post-war era. They went from a sort of feudal society, I believe, and you can correct me if I'm wrong on this, to a quite an advanced, modern, developed country in a very short space of time, using basically mercantilist policies where they did a lot of investment. They had these vertically integrated car companies, and they built a lot of wealth in these, you know, car companies, technology companies, and other things like this. So what was your impressions of Japan? Do you think it's more technologically advanced and more economically developed than we are, or do you think that's maybe a bit of a myth?
Yeah, I think before I go into some of the other bits of sort of where we went, I think as you mentioned, the fact that it used to be a feudal society features quite heavily in many of the things that we went to see. And they were very opposed to foreign intervention for many centuries, almost from the 1600s to the mid-1600s to the mid-1800s. They were basically closed off to the world. There was sort of one exception, which was with the Dutch. And that was there was actually a statue in Tokyo Station of a Dutch samurai, and it's kind of, it's like the first foreigner to become samurai was a Dutchman, and he basically had brokered a special deal with the shogunate to allow the Dutch to trade with Japan, and they were closed off, and like you said, they remained feudal for centuries as the rest of the world moved on, and they were eventually opened up forcefully by the Americans in the 1800s, and because of that, they built their big empire. After World War II, of course, Japan was basically flattened, and they very, very rapidly advanced, and they've become famous for their technology. But something that we found is that actual Japanese society doesn't seem that technologically advanced, in the sense it almost feels like they have frozen their technology. They've become very conservative in their own use and adoption of technology, and you don't see as much technological advancement in many of their systems they use every day. So everything is paper-based, for instance. You go to the train station to order a ticket from the man behind the counter, and he'll get out a big logbook, like a binder. He'll go through like paper tables, and they'll print out paper tickets. Very efficient, very fast, but they've basically not upgraded these systems. A lot of their good technology are things like trains that run very efficiently, very smoothly, very quickly, but trains aren't new technology either. And then very, very heavily cash-based society as well. So they haven't really gone all in on these digital, you know, everything's sort of pay wave here, and stores don't like to handle cash, but very, very heavily focused on cash, preference for cash everywhere. And some, you know, in many places, you can't even pay with a card. It's considered very, very normal to not use that kind of technology. So very, very selective in the kinds of technology that they've integrated into everyday life.
And is that a deliberate policy choice that they've made? So in the Western world, I kind of feel, at least, that we place ourselves at the mercy of technology and technological advancement, and the idea that a new technology could be developed and we wouldn't just immediately make it available to anyone doesn't seem to be a policy choice our leaders would be willing to even contemplate. But what you're describing, and tell me if I'm wrong, is that they're making a deliberate choice not to deploy some of these digital technologies in their everyday life.
I actually don't know for sure. Very, very hard to tell. But if you think about things like the train companies, these are private companies. It's not like the government has frozen the technology and forgotten to invest in their train system, for instance, in their ticketing, in the way they do their ticketing and their scheduling. These are private companies that make a lot of money off running trains. The public transport there is actually quite expensive compared to New Zealand, even, I think. But it's so much better. So, you know, you feel like you're getting value for money. And I don't think it's purely cultural, because otherwise, you know, why would private companies not innovate and use that technology to save money?
Well, that's interesting. I wonder
But it could also be that because of the way their society is structured, as a very conservative, that you've got these older generations, the boomers, basically the Japanese boomers, who are just, you know, what do we need this new technology for? We don't need it. That's possible. There's an attitude like that as well.
I wondered whether they were making a sort of deliberate choice as a society, like the Amish, but on a less extreme sort of scale, in order to preserve their sort of culture and way of life and integrate technology on their own terms rather than being at the mercy of technology.
It was a comment that Amy made. It was like she said it felt like they had made a deal to keep their technology frozen in the 1990s if they could also keep their culture and their high trust society, all of the really positive aspects of the country, frozen in that kind of time period as well. That's what it felt like a little bit as well. If I move on to that aspect, absolutely the case that very, very polite, lots and lots of little rules, social cues, things you need to follow. It's not just anything goes. And many of these rules are basically unwritten rules. And we used to be like that. I mean, I don't remember. It was before my living memory. But I know for sure, and you know, looking back at old videos and films taken of New Zealand society and the way that people dressed and behaved and walked around, and the general quietness and politeness and homogeneity of society, that's what we used to have. And that was all taken away from us. And it's almost like the Japanese made a deal to kind of stay frozen in time.
Yeah, I remember, and this is something that happened a decade or maybe more ago, that there was this talk about Asian values and the idea that Asian values were responsible for the rapid economic growth and development of many of the Asian economies, like the Asian tigers we used to hear about and things like this. And part of the Asian values were these, you know, the values of hard work and discipline, studying hard in school, saving up your money, like having accumulating a large amount of savings is a big part of, I think, the story of Asian economic development, including Japan. But like you say, those values, they're not really unique to Asia. They used to be European values as well. It's just that we've kind of lost our values a little bit. We've slowly degenerated over time.
It really felt like the similarities, like many of these things were not different to Europe. And especially like if you're a Japanese feudal history, you learn about it, you visit these places. If I go back to one of the questions I asked at the beginning about where did I go, we got into Tokyo. We were there for a couple of days, not in the center of Tokyo. We came back to that later, but sort of just more on the outskirts, almost say suburbs, but it's all very, very dense, not quite suburbs over there. And then we moved up into a rural area up to the north in a little area called Nikko. Sort of was an old onsen town, and which is basically onsens are sort of their baths, public baths and so on, springs, hot springs, and lovely, more rural town up in the mountains, and getting to experience that more traditional way of doing things, staying in an old inn where you'd sleep on the floor, basically. You know, they put on the mats, they put down your blankets, and you'd sleep on those. They would serve you the traditional meals, so you'd get like 7-course meals. You'd have for breakfast and for dinner, you'd have like raw fish if you're into it, but you know, raw fish for breakfast and rice for breakfast, and just the way they would traditionally feed, I guess, the more upper class people. The poor people probably didn't eat 7-course meals, but not a word of English spoken, very difficult to communicate, very little technology in the sense, like the trains there, perfectly maintained, look brand new, but like they hadn't changed since the 1960s, 1950s, and completely beautiful. And then they had some of their old cultural areas there as well. We would call it, I think, an open air museum. We have a little bit of this in New Zealand, not very much, but an open air museum that's run by people who dress up as people from their feudal period, the Edo area. It's called Edo Wonderland. Great place to visit. We got to dress up and be Japanese lords and ladies for a day. Got to be a samurai, and Amy got to be a princess. And they treat you based on, you know, sort of what outfit you choose, and you get to experience a lot of their traditional way of doing plays, and the way that they would explain how they would do, you know, used to do things back in their feudal period. And if you've ever been to that kind of experience in Europe, there's actually a lot of things you realize, oh, that's kind of similar, but just Japanese version of what the Europeans used to have and used to do. So we really enjoyed getting that very rural, very traditional experience. And they've actually done a good job of keeping that alive. I think it's very hard to get that authentically in any other part of the world. They've done a really good job of maintaining and making it something that you can experience.
I think I saw those pictures. I think you posted them on social media of you dressing.
I did post one or two of those, and on my wife's private Instagram, she's posted a lot more for friends and family. But yeah, a great, great, wonderful experience. And then, you know, we did this again in Korea as well. We went to Korea afterwards, which I actually found fairly similar to Japan with a few differences. But so after we did this kind of rural experience in Japan, we went across to the two kind of old traditional cities, Kanazawa and Kyoto, both old cities. They were on the west coast, I think, of Japan, which didn't get bombed by the Americans so much. They still had a lot of their old palaces, old gardens, beautiful stuff. You know, in their gardens, they maintain each individual tree, basically. They have guys who prune each tree. So each pine tree will be manually pruned and tweaked. They have guys who get up at 6 o'clock in the morning, like these guys who look old, like in their 60s and 70s, maybe not 70s, it's hard to tell, but definitely in their 60s. And they're sweeping the streets with brooms at 6, 7 o'clock in the morning. They're raking up all the leaves that are on the paths so that when people walk there, there's no leaves. You know, they pick up the trash as well, but they go so far as to pick up the leaves and from the parks in the morning, just things like that. Amazing. And we spent a bit more time in some of the cities, went to Osaka, went through to, as I said, to Korea, did similar things in Korea as well in terms of getting that rural experience and seeing the big city there as well, Seoul, and then went back to Tokyo to experience the Tokyo Central, which somebody asked me, said, was it like New York, sort of, be like an Asian version of New York? And I said, yeah, that's what central Tokyo felt like, very different to the rest of Japan. One of these cities that's sort of one of these 24/7 cities, and more so just busy, just so many people, and also just full of tourists. I think that's something that Japanese have complained about, is over tourism, having just so many foreigners in these cities and these tourist hotspots all the time. Kyoto was probably the worst for that. It felt like it was central Auckland instead of Kyoto, in the terms of like the demographics, like 50% Chinese, 50% Chinese tourists in Kyoto. And of course, because of that, you get a lot more noise. You get a lot more Japanese people who are upset by the noisy tourists, and they will complain about that, which I understand now that I've experienced it. Having been a tourist there, I understand why the locals would be upset.
Yeah, so I guess that's one of the key differences between Japan and New Zealand, or indeed most Western countries, is maybe not most, but many Western countries now, is the changing demographics. Japan, you know, it managed to sort of hold off from being integrated into the global economy for a long time. And it also seems to have been able to hold off being opening its borders to mass immigration in the way that many other Western countries, or many other developed countries, have sort of succumbed to. So I checked the statistics before I came on here for this interview, and Japan is still 97.4% Japanese, according to the stats I've got here. So that compares, that's a very high percentage, obviously. I mean, I've looked
at it. It makes it one of the most homogenous countries on earth, I think. But you wouldn't be able to tell that it's 97% Japanese if you're in one of the big cities. But I think that's, again, people say, oh, look, it's all this immigration into Japan. But most of that is going to be tourism, simply just because of the very high volumes of tourists. When you go somewhere rural, you will see only Japanese people, just 100% Japanese as soon as you step outside the cities.
So that you don't really notice the urban areas being sort of more ethnically homogenous than Western countries.
It's simply hard to tell, simply because of the tourists, because there are so many tourists. You can't tell, is this person a tourist? Is this person trying, you know, is this person living here? Very difficult to tell. But having been there, I tell you, there are a lot of tourists. And we didn't go during a particularly busy time. We're here in basically an autumn period, which is far less busy than, say, the spring, which is when there are the most tourists. And I couldn't imagine just how chaotic and busy it would be. And again, if you go to areas that tourists go to, you'd see like 90% tourists in some of these areas.
Do you think the conservatism, I think your answer to this is going to be yes. Do you think their conservatism and their desire to protect their culture is what, first of all, enabled them to sort of stay out of the global trading system for so long, and then also hold off from allowing large numbers of immigrants to come into Japan? Do you think that has something to do with it, or do you think there's something else driving that?
Yes, their conservatism is stronger than probably anywhere else in the world at the moment, and they have a very strong history of that. So they had this protectionist period, this closed period, where they sealed off Japan from the rest of the world for hundreds of years, and they've managed to maintain that. So they've been far, I guess a term that they use, that political theorists would use, is like ultra-conservative or something along those lines, you know, ultra-mega, hyper-conservative. And that must still remain in the country at the moment, and that's reflected in their political system and their voting system. I noted in their elections, you know, being there when they held them, the results were not very good for the ruling party, known as the Liberal Democratic Party, but for the term, you know, having the words liberal and democratic in their party, they are much more right-wing than, say, our National Party is much more right-wing than that. And then they've got challengers to the right. So they had two new parties basically enter their parliament, one of them being, and I'm not sure if I pronounced this correctly, Sanseto, and they are basically sort of an anti, like they were formed during COVID. It's like a freedom party, sort of considered to be anti-vax and all the conspiracy, blah, 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 all of that stuff. But they're considered to be a far-right ultra-nationalist party to the right, you know, anti-immigration. And then they got three seats in the Japanese parliament, which is actually quite difficult because it's a first-past-the-post system, and you're not even allowed to be featured in polling and get special funding unless you already have seats in parliament. So just trying to clear that hurdle there is very difficult. They very tightly restrict the political system, and there's a lot less interest from people in politics. It's largely considered to be one of these countries where people don't care about politics, and that's because the political issues aren't that big. If I were to explain to you what their political issues are, I think we would consider them to be very, very small. And then the other party got three seats as well, as a party called the Conservative Party, which, you know, is, you think about this as a Western country having a Conservative Party that just gets founded in the year 2023, 2024 and gets into Parliament. It seems kind of strange almost. And their position there, the reason they were founded is because the main, you know, the ruling so-called Conservative Party, which again, is far more conservative than our right-wing parties, signed a bill saying that they've recognized like an LGBT recognition bill or something, saying kind of basically, the party said, oh, you know, it's okay to be gay. And you actually had a faction split off from that and form their own party saying, no, we don't want any of this homosexuality in Japan. And they got seats in parliament. You know, trying to imagine any Western country where a party like that right wing could actually get seats in parliament. And that's what happened in Japan 2 weeks ago. And of course, the ruling party lost a lot of seats. It's basically a hung parliament there at the moment. And the reason the ruling party lost seats was largely because of its own scandals. They basically had slush fund scandals where MPs were taking money, siphoning money off and spending it on their own campaigns and their own things that they wanted to spend money on. That is what was super damaging to the main party, and people, you know, voted for the opposition on sort of on that issue. Whereas if you, I think if you had a slush fund scandal in New Zealand, people would say, yeah, okay, maybe the National Party is doing weird things, you know, is taking a few million dollars and put it off to the side and done their own little things with it. But going to the other side, they're going to destroy the country. So we're not voting for those guys who are going to destroy the country. There's no such concern like that in Japan. It's not like the other party has a radically different policy platform. The other party is campaigning on transparency and anti-corruption. And like that's the big political issue in Japan largely.
Yeah, so you're describing a parliament and a political environment that's much more conservative and much sort of further the center of mass or center of weight in the debate is much further to the right. In Western parties, we've kind of got this, you know, people talk about the uni party in the United States, and there's this idea that both, you know, the main left-wing parties and the main right-wing parties and Western countries are still sort of adhere to this, I don't know what the right words for it is, but neoliberal consensus or something like that. Is that view represented in Japan's parliament at all? Or is there sort of a consensus built around maintaining a homogenous conservative Japan instead?
To a large degree, I would say yes. They have parties that are more open to, say, immigration, but then their immigration system is very, very strict. Like in order to become, nobody's talking about loosening up their citizenship requirements, for instance, which require you to become completely fluent in Japanese, which alone is an incredibly difficult thing to do. If anybody watches any of these YouTubers or travel vloggers who have lived in Japan for a decade, many of them probably after a decade would barely qualify for becoming citizens. In fact, most of them, I doubt, would even be able to become citizens after living there for 10 years or more. So very, very different approach, very, very difficult for people to actually go there and to become Japanese. And even then you might never, you know, you never really be fully accepted into Japan. I know several people who have tried to live in Japan and found it very, very difficult because they actually force you to integrate and to assimilate in a way that's very, very hard, like to a very, very high standard. And I don't see anyone in Japanese politics really talking seriously about relaxing that. It's more so about, oh, we need more temporary workers, you know, like we need more workers on these sort of residency visas. But if you're a resident in Japan, you can't vote, you can't influence the political system. Very, very different to New Zealand. And you do see more of that. Some might say, unfortunately, in Japan, definitely see more non-Japanese people working in various sectors, especially, I think, where they interact with tourists, because I guess they would say, oh, you speak English, and so you can have a job here. But even their thing of high-skilled immigrants, I saw non-Japanese people working jobs like sitting at a desk in a hotel or doing a train station ticketing job and so on. You're like, you know, when they talk about the high-skilled immigration, how do the, you know, is this really considered a high-skilled job? New Zealand has the same problems where the government's telling you, like, oh, yes, we have high-skilled immigrants coming in. And it's pretty clear that the standards for high skill are not what they're made out to be.
Yeah, so I guess we've talked about immigration, and it's things are very different in Japan than they are in New Zealand or other Western countries. But the other main demographic feature we should probably discuss is the birth rates. Japan actually has one of the lowest fertility rates in the world of 1.4, which is lower even than New Zealand's. And New Zealand's is quite low at 1.66. And I think this is a big issue in Japan, from what I understand, like that their population is going to shrink by tens of millions of people under the current and incoming sort of decades. So is this something that is noticeable when you're sort of walking around enjoying Japanese culture as a tourist, or is this something that the people conveyed to you as a problem in any way?
So the first thing we actually noticed on our first day in Tokyo was all of these primary schools that were doing tours of this particular park that we were visiting. We had all these school kids, like everywhere all day was just school kids in central Tokyo. But like Tokyo is a big city, would have lots of schools. Definitely further out in the countryside, didn't really see children very much. One area where I thought I would see more kids was, for instance, going to church in Japan. Went to church there. The people who had kids were basically foreigners who had moved to Japan, Christian foreigners who had kids. The Japanese people there didn't really see them have that many kids, which was an interesting contrast to being in Korea, which I think is worth contrasting. Korea, officially South Korea, has a lower birth rate than Japan. But when I was at church there, they had far more children. You wouldn't have noticed lower birth rates there. And of course, you would expect Christians to have more children. But I didn't really see, at least from what I saw, it seemed like that was the lower birth rates is a far bigger issue in Japan. And a lot of what seems to depress that is basically a work culture. There seems to be something very heavily focused around work and looking like you're working and people doing 12-hour work days. You'd see people sleeping on the trains. Overall, all the systems seem to be more so hostile to having children, having families. Rurally, you can see areas running empty. So you could definitely see empty buildings, derelict buildings, collapsed buildings, just places that were abandoned. Not because there's no money, but just because there's no people, there's no reason to have those buildings. But in the big cities, they would still have construction going on, building more buildings. So clearly more people moving into the city. I do believe this is a political issue there as well, although I didn't see it visibly being seen as an issue. They had an interesting thing on trains, like during rush hour, they have like women-only cars, so the carriages of trains that only women are allowed to use. So something interesting, I guess, that we don't really have in New Zealand. I'm not sure if it's because of a negative thing people say, because women are... need to be kept safe because of dangerous people. There are kind of, but you don't really get that impression from them either. That's the case. And it seemed like, on the whole, seems like a very, very safe society, far safer than New Zealand. Like if any country needed you think like a country like New Zealand would need women-only carriages on the public transport, when you see the videos of like people getting beaten up on the trains and buses and things like that. That just doesn't happen in Japan.
You've talked about going to church there. So, I mean, I just, as a sort of side issue, I just wanted to ask you about the state of Christianity in Japan. Because from what I understand, at various points in their history, the Japanese authorities have tried very hard to drive Christianity out of their society. And so they can, I guess, maintain their, I think their religion is called Shinto, but whether it's a religion or part of the culture is sort of mixed together or something like that. So I wonder if you have any insights on that side of things.
Yeah, this is a very fascinating subject, actually. I like it. And you're right, Shinto is their local religion, and Buddhism as well is like a mix of Shinto and Buddhism. There were times in their history where, say, the emperor or the shogun banned Buddhism as well and tried to maintain their Shinto religion. It's hard to call it a religion because it's largely just ancestor worship. There's nothing really to it, as far as I could tell, by the way, beyond sort of ancestor worship. But Christianity in Japan is perfectly acceptable, but it's got an interesting history. I may as well start from the beginning and get to the political scandals of the modern day after that. But you had Roman Catholics, Jesuits mostly come to Japan in the 1500s, who were Portuguese, and many Japanese people became Christians. Many of the Japanese lords became Christians, but eventually there was a power struggle and the shogun turned against the Christian lords. I thought they would undermine his power, and basically Christianity was banned from Japan. And it remained that way for a long time, but especially after World War II, when the Japanese were defeated, they realized, as many people as has happened historically, is, oh no, we, you know, our gods have failed us, right? We've been conquered by another people. Should we adopt their gods, should we, or their god in this case? And so they became far more welcoming to Christianity, really, because they had lost, basically, they had lost to a Christian power, and the Christians are more powerful. But the Americans were very liberal, and they were like, well, we're not going to force Christianity on you. We just want, you know, we want you to adopt this voluntarily. And so Japan simply changed the rules to say, okay, well, Christian missionaries are welcome. So we'll give visas to missionaries who are coming. So any missionaries from the Western world could come. And many missionaries from New Zealand came as well. Didn't meet any kind of influence from there. Where I went was mostly American and Dutch influenced. But less than 1% of Japanese people are Christians. And actually the public views it sort of negatively as almost like a cult, because there is a cult called the Unification Church, or the Moonies, I think is what they're sometimes known as, who have a lot of influence in Japanese politics. And part of the slush fund scandal I mentioned earlier, there's a connections to these people from the Unification Church making political donations. And Japanese people are worried that these religious sects are having influence over Japanese politics. And Japanese society, it seems like, instead of becoming Christian or becoming more Shinto after World War II, it's actually become very secular. They don't really have any genuine religious belief. Even many of them who still practice their Shinto belief, you know, go to the family shrine or graves and so on, they're basically just secular. It doesn't influence their daily lives. They're very non-religious society. And I think that is perhaps even more advanced than the secularization of many Western countries like New Zealand. And that's led to a lot of, I guess, sort of depression and doom and gloom of, like, there's no hope. There's no sort of spiritual hope in Japan at all. And the Christians there seem very, I think they struggle. Very, very difficult thing to be a Christian in Japan, not because of the Buddhists or the Shinto beliefs, but simply because of the heavy secularism. It's almost heavier than the secularism you would find in New Zealand and Australia and America and Canada and so on.
That's interesting, yeah. So you've talked about World War II a little bit there and the secularization that occurred after World War II. Now, you and I have talked before sort of at length about the sort of the change in psychology that came about in Western countries post-World War II, and sort of the change in ruling ideology, I guess, that has been ushered in after World War II as a result of, you know, the Nazis and the Holocaust and all these sorts of things. Japan was actually on the side of the Axis powers in World War II. And yet, unlike Germany, say, which is sort of, you know, if I were to talk about the psychological state of the German people as a whole, that it's sort of like they've been defeated and they're in a sort of state of abolishing themselves largely. Whereas what you're describing in Japan is that although they've become more secular, there's still a sort of very strong cultural conservatism and a very strong desire to preserve themselves demographically and culturally. So how do you think World War II, the impact of World War II, has been felt differently in Japan to, say, like Germany or other Western countries?
I would go so far as to say it's the complete opposite of what happened to Germany. And far more so than when I first... I knew that, you know, they sort of viewed World War II in a more neutral light, but I was quite surprised, actually, with the way that seems like it hasn't affected them at all. And I was just going to make a little joke here to be like, oh, you can see swastikas everywhere in the country. That's because of Buddhism, of course. Just
Sure it is.
You go to the Buddhist temples and so on, there you'll see thousands and thousands of swastikas everywhere. But it's got nothing to do with World War II, cough, cough. Okay. The main interesting thing there in the politics of the right wing is more pro-military and pro-America as well, who defeated them. They don't seem to be too worried about the fact that the Americans defeated them. They love American things. Lots of foods are American influenced that they have fully embraced. They've turned them into Japanese foods, but they've embraced those things. Baseball is their national sport. They love baseball because of the Americans. The kids all play baseball. It's the number one sport. And the right wing is fully supportive of American military bases, the American military being there, and also of rebuilding the Japanese military. They're very concerned about aggression from China, from North Korea, very much pro-military on the right wing of politics. The left wing of politics there is, I guess, a little bit crazy and more insane in the sense of they're anti the American military bases, but also anti the Japanese military. So they want to get rid of the military and think if we get rid of the Americans and we get rid of our military, then Japan and North Korea won't see us as a threat, which anybody can instantly tell is just an insane idea. Because like if you don't have a military, someone who is militaristic is just going to roll over you instantly. So that's completely non-feasible. But it's a very minor issue politically, I think, because it's basically impossible to demilitarize. So the right wing, they're far more in favor of the military. The general populace, as far as you can tell, are very much sort of pro the US military being there and the Japanese military being built up. And then they have a museum. What at first it was a museum, just simply a museum dedicated to the Japanese Empire, the Japanese army, remembering the war dead. So I went to this museum and it's surrounded by a massive, massive wall. And inside that wall is a shrine. And the shrine is like 3-4 times the size of the museum. It's a Shinto shrine. And I went into the museum and I started reading the descriptions. And they've got stuff, you know, the descriptions are all like pro-Japan. Like, here's the artillery that we just got back from Iwo Jima, where our glorious heroes bravely died fighting the invaders and defending Japan. And they then talk about how there's, I think, a million and a half deities enshrined in this museum area in the complex. And they've actually taken, said that all of their soldiers who have died fighting for the Japanese Empire over the last 150 years, their souls are enshrined in this shrine, and they worship them, and they put out offerings to them. So they basically worship their war heroes. So if you want to give a parallel to this, imagine going to like somewhere in Germany, and you've got all the World War II military history and the World War I and all of this stuff in full display, and you've got all the guys out there talking about how great their leaders were, how great their soldiers were. And this is a massive museum in the middle of Tokyo that is called controversy, diplomatic incidents, but it's viewed very favorably by the people there. It's allowed to exist and thrives, and I guess is incredibly large for what I thought it would be. So they view their history, their empire, very, very positively. Of course, they add a little bit of, we hope for world peace now, we want world peace, to add that onto the end of it. And that's how they view their history.
That's really interesting, because I think a lot of people in the West and America perhaps viewed it as a necessity that German patriotic feeling be destroyed so that something like World War II could never happen again. But what you're describing in Japan is a country that's managed to preserve its sense of itself, its cultural conservatism, its sort of patriotic feeling and its nationalism, while sort of reorienting its idea of who its allies and its enemies are to sort of embrace the people who conquered and defeated it in World War II. It seems like a much more psychologically healthy response to World War II than perhaps what we've seen in some other countries.
I would absolutely agree with that. From what I saw a very, as you say, very psychologically healthy country in regards of how they view themselves and their history. The negative part, of course, is in terms of the fact that population collapse, as you've mentioned, and birth rates declining, and there's them not really having an answer to that. But then again, neither do we. And so this is where things become particularly difficult, is they're just simply further along in that population collapse than we are, in the reverse way that we are much further ahead in the other social degradation that's gone on, right? We had all this feminism and the gay rights and trans rights and all of that social progressivism is like two or three decades behind there. You can see it. Like, for instance, their social issue is like, we need more women representation in parliament or whatever, which it feels like is something that has sort of mostly disappeared from mainstream discourse in New Zealand is not really considered to be a big deal. Like, oh, we did that already. We had 50% women in parliament like 10, 20 years ago. That's the kind of, so it feels like they're being dragged along towards that, towards where we are on that front. And so people saying, well, Japan's doing really well resisting this. They're just behind on that front. And when it comes to the birth rates, we're not resisting it. You know, like they're just ahead of where we are. And so it's interesting. It will be interesting to see, you know, can we stop the wokeness here, then it can be stopped in Japan. But if we can't stop the wokeness here, then they can't stop it in Japan either. They just have 20, 30 years left before they go down the toilet. And if the birth rates, then if they don't have an answer to population collapse, well, then we won't either. I think we'll be gone as well. So, it may be inevitable. They may simply be adapting to having fewer people in their country. And that seems to be, that is an attitude I did see over there. People said, well, even with projected population collapse, the population goes back to like higher levels than before World War II still, you know, sort of like, can we take a step back from the baby boom to like population levels that we used to have 100 years ago? Whether that can be done, I don't know. It seems like a very dangerous thing to bank on, but it may be inevitable, it may be unavoidable. And trying to use mass migration and the Great Replacement doesn't fix that problem. It just makes it worse and adds a second problem you need to solve.
Yeah, birth rates, low birth rates can be self-correcting because what can happen is that obviously in each successive generation, the people who have more children make up a larger proportion of the population than the people who have a lower birth rate. And so if propensity to have children is in part a genetic, then the higher propensity to have more children comes through the generations as you're going along. It's a more complicated story than that, but the point is that low birth rates can be self-correcting in the absence of other things that upset the balance. And another thing perhaps we should touch on is geopolitics. And I'm not sure whether you would have gathered too much about this from your trip or not. But, you know, the big thing, one of the big things happening in the world right now is the rise of China. China and Russia kind of allying, and Western powers, the US and NATO, and also New Zealand and Australia sort of trying to balance the influence. So the US, Australia, and New Zealand balancing the influence of China in the Pacific. And Japan is a big part of that strategy for the US in terms of balancing China and Chinese influence. Japan is like the, I don't know, maybe like an aircraft carrier.
Japan is the US's unsinkable aircraft carrier. That's sort of, I think, yes, they are like that, and they actually embrace that role as America's unsinkable aircraft carrier. Interesting, as I said, like so many Chinese tourists that the Japanese complain about it. You know, I didn't see this in real life, but I saw it on social media, and I thought, yeah, this is absolutely true. Like a sign in Kyoto, which said no vacancy in English, and then said the same in Chinese. And then below that, it said, and Japanese, if you can read this, feel free to come in. So that's the kind of, there can be a bit of that kind of attitude towards these tourists to say, we don't, you know, the tourists who can read English and Chinese, we don't want them. but they're a very, very popular tourist destination for people coming from China. So it's not like relations between those countries have deteriorated to the point where you haven't got tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people moving backwards and forwards between these countries every month.
It's interesting. So as a New Zealander touring Japan, what kind of reaction did you get from the Japanese people towards New Zealand and New Zealanders? Did they have any sort of, maybe they wouldn't have said anything about it, or maybe they
So nothing negative beyond, like I said, we sometimes you'd have a case where you go try and go in somewhere like a restaurant and they'd speak to you in Japanese, and you try and communicate, like, have you got a table? Can we sit down? And once we ran into a case where the guy just sort of stared and looked at us and just spoke Japanese and then said nothing. And we just ended up turning around and leaving. So sometimes you come across this case of people who just don't want to speak to foreigners or don't want to have foreigners in their establishment. But that only happened once or twice. For the most part, very, very welcoming, very, very happy to sort of go out of their way to help you and make sure that you know what's going on. That was very, very positive. And then they ask you, where are you from? New Zealand. Oh, New Zealand. Oh, yes, they love, they're excited, all good. But you'd also get, oh, I'm a New Zealander, think kind of, okay, but where are you really from? Kind of like, you know, so they'd probe further, like, okay, but where are your ancestors from? Was your, you know, what European country are you from? So that you'd be probed further on that. So often we'd get back to that, so back to being Dutch, and my wife would go be sort of Scottish, and then they'd be happy with that answer. So that was kind of interesting, almost unexpected, in that they weren't necessarily always happy by just saying you were a New Zealander as an answer. Just like you'd get in New Zealand, maybe it's like kind of a where are you really from a question that they would add on as well. Well, sort of an understanding, like they had, an understanding of like how colonies work, because Japan was a colonial power, of course. So that seems to be something they still understand more so than maybe other places.
Yeah. Any further sort of reflections on Japan? I'm kind of running towards the end of the questions I've got written down here for you, so I don't want to leave anything out if you've got important things you want to tell the audience.
I think for the most part, you've got it. I mean, there's so much to say. You could go on for hours, but I think we've really covered the gist of it. Perhaps one thing I might mention would be about the health culture that they have. So we've talked about them having like a healthy culture and being a strong culture, but they also have a very health-focused culture, eat a lot of good, healthy foods, walk everywhere. Like there's nowhere to
sit. Do the Japanese have one of the highest life expectancies in the world? Am I right about that?
They do have one of the highest life expectancies in the world, yes. Whether you could attribute that to good genes or to just healthy living, there's basically no overweight people. You never see overweight Japanese people. If you saw overweight people, they were American tourists. And you could tell the reason that is because there's nowhere to sit in public. There's like nowhere to sit. They have rules against eating, and you're not allowed to eat. And speaking of all the rules, they have lots and lots of little rules you kind of need to. They try and teach you some of them if you're on the trains, like away from the airport. They've got little signs of like, here's what to do and not to do, and they go on and on. There's like dozens of them. Little social things they want to make sure you respect. And that's impressive compared to a country like New Zealand, where it's kind of, you just do your own culture and people do whatever they want. No, if you're visiting them, they expect you to follow their rules, and very, very important to them that you follow their rules. And things like, yes, walking, you can't walk around and eat or drink. You have to stand in particular places or sit down out of the way. They've got vending machines everywhere with water and other drinks. So really big focus. And I guess Amy said it was because they had things like elderly people who would get dehydrated in the summer and die of like heat stroke in the summer. They've got vending machines everywhere. Like every street has its own vending machine, and you can just buy water or soft drinks or even beer. You can just put $1.50 into a vending machine and get a can of beer out of it on the street. And part of that comes from it being like a very high trust society, same thing, somebody asked.
Surely we can duplicate this technology. Why can we not bring that to New Zealand?
We can duplicate the technology, but we can't duplicate the good manners to have people use it responsibly and not like destroy these machines and do all kinds of bad things. That seems to be the bigger problem here. Same thing with like you buy alcohol in the convenience store and it just says pops up like, are you 20? Are you 20 years old? And there's only one button that says yes that you have to tap. Like they don't ask for your ID. You have to, they just trust that you're being honest. Very high trust society. And all the food is, again, very, very, very healthy food and smaller portions. And they focus on walking everywhere, and people don't just get to sit down, which can be annoying if you're a tourist and you're exploring and you've been walking for hours and hours and hours, and then there's just like nowhere to sit. There are no seats anywhere. You get very sore feet at the end of the day. But we had a really great time, if I were to sum everything up. I really enjoyed it. Very special. And if anything, you'd call it radicalizing, just to see what's been taken away from us, because that we used to have these things in our own countries. We used to have these high trust societies, we used to have people who were well behaved, and it's not like it's not like, oh, that was in the past, right? They've got it in the present day, and so it was a deliberate choice to have lost all of that, to have all of that taken away from us. So it makes me almost angrier at the political system here in New Zealand. And even might as well mention this, the thing that surprised me in terms of the tourists who were there were many tourists from Eastern Europe, and it just made me realize the fact that Eastern Europeans have a standard of living where they can afford tourism in Japan now. Compare that to 100 years ago when New Zealand was the richest country in the world and Eastern Europeans were crushed by Nazism and communism for 70 years. And the Eastern Europeans, if you look at their standards of living now, they're like almost as high as New Zealand. They'll overtake us in a decade or two. And you think about the fact that while they've been crushed by Nazism and communism, we've been run by the National and Labour Party for the last 100 years. And the damage that the National Party and the Labour Party have done is insane. That the standard of living of New Zealanders relative to other people as you have dropped to that point where you're seeing tourists from countries that you grew up thinking were poor countries, and they're now wealthier countries than we are. And that's because of the decisions made by national Labour governments for the last 100 years. In that time, we've lost all of the great things that the Japanese had, and we've lost our economic position in the world, where we're like as poor as the Eastern Europeans now. So that's maybe a bit of a negative thing to end it on. Things are bad in New Zealand, but sometimes it's what happens. You go overseas and you see these nice things, and you realize that we could have them, and that they've been taken away from us. But absolutely enjoy Japan. Would highly recommend it. Beautiful, beautiful country. Wonderful people, and great culture and history.
Oh, well, perhaps that's a good note to end on. So, thank you. You've been listening to Diwa de Boer talking to me, William McGimsey, about his trip to Japan. And I'll be talking to you again soon. I think we're going to do a weekly roundup discussion. So,
absolutely. After this break, we'll change roles, and I'm keen to speak to you about the political activities from the last week.
Thanks. I'll talk to you in a minute.
Thanks for tuning in to RCR, Reality Check Radio. Do you like what you're listening to, or dislike what you're listening to? Either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057. That's 2057. Or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We'd love to hear from you, so connect with us today.